When I was asked to speak on the book of Daniel, the conveners of these meetings asked me to look at the lives of Daniel and his friends from the perspective of how the people of God should live when the pressure is on, when the heat is on. Now, of course, Daniel and his friends lived in a pre-Christian era. Their circumstances were different from ours. But I feel quite sure that as we look at this book, and particularly now these first six chapters, we shall be able to find many things that are helpful to us as we seek to live for God in an environment where the basic thrust of things is opposed to God. Now, first of all, let us get ourselves into the right setting here. The great nation of Israel, over which David ruled, didn't remain great for very long. Later on, it was split into two parts, northern and southern. There was conflict and there was disappointment. And finally, the people fell under foreign rule. The northern part of the kingdom was wiped out. And when we come to the time of Daniel here, the southern part of the ancient kingdom, all that was left of that ancient glorious nation over which David ruled, all that is left is the tribe of Judah and a few bits and pieces stuck on. It was called the Kingdom of Judah, and its capital was Jerusalem. And now it too was on its last legs. In 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon led his forces against Jerusalem, attacked the place, and Jerusalem now fell under the control of Babylon. And what Nebuchadnezzar did was to take some of the leading youths of the chief families of Jerusalem, the aristocracy, the people that had a bit of breeding, and he took them off into Babylon to train them in the royal court so that they could be administrators in his kingdom. Obviously, Nebuchadnezzar intended to stay around a long time and impose his will upon Jewish affairs. And so he got these best Jewish youth that he could find to prepare them for a long involvement of Babylon in the affairs of the Jewish nation. Now, this was the first of Babylon's attacks upon Jerusalem. As you read on, you'll find that there are going to be other attacks. And finally, Jerusalem will be destroyed and the people taken off into captivity in Babylon. But at the start of the story here in Daniel chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar has invaded for the first time, and he's only taken off a limited number of people, only the pick of the people. He's taken them off to Babylon, and there in the royal court they are to be trained. So the setting is now in Babylon. The book of Daniel is set in Babylon. The people that he has taken are Jewish people who are now no longer in the secure environment of their own nation. They are no longer supported by the religious institutions of their own nation. They are in a hostile, anti-God environment. And I would like to make the parallel between them and us. God's people, pictured here as being out of the secure church environment into a hostile environment. Now, here we all are as a group of Christians, and we feel secure. We support each other, we believe more or less the same things, and we feel confident. But how do we fare when we are out of this environment in the world outside where things are more hostile? That is the setting for this story, and I want to read it in that light. We find that Nebuchadnezzar has introduced all sorts of pressures upon these people so that they might conform to the new system. I think the best thing to do at this stage is simply to read through the first eight verses. We are reasonably familiar with this book. We'll read through the first eight verses and so get ourselves into the picture. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar. Shinar is Babylon. To the house of his God, and he placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch. The chief eunuch was the man who was in charge of the royal household. A eunuch was a man who had been emasculated. De-sexed is the veterinary expression that's used commonly today, just to make sure that these chaps didn't interfere with the harem women. But this man is the chief of those chaps to be found in the royal household. And this Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch, had to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youth without blemish, handsome and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding learning, and competent to serve in the king's palace, and he was now to teach them the letters and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the rich food which the king ate, and of the wine which he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's rich food, or with the wine which he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And we'll stop there for the time being. Here we have the pressures that are brought to bear upon these people. And we are in a society where pressures are brought to bear upon us. Now, I'm not saying that there's any organization, some mysterious group of Illuminati or someone who are trying to get at us, that there's some conspiracy where an organization has set itself up to obliterate Christianity from our minds. Obviously, there are some people who are opposed to Christianity. But whether people are actively opposed, deliberately opposed, or whether it's entirely unintentional, the fact is that we do live in a society where there are all sorts of pressures which come from a general background of ungodliness, of people who do not accept God, do not believe in God, and whose values and standards are not those of God's kingdom. And we are subject to these pressures, just as these Jews were subject to the pressures placed upon them. I have summarized these under four headings: religious pressures, social pressures, educational pressures, and personal pressures. That may be a little artificial, but it's a summary nevertheless, and it will serve to bring out a few points. Firstly, the religious pressures. The vessels of the house of God in Jerusalem had been taken and placed in the temple of the god in Babylon. This was a very ancient way of showing that the god of the conquering nation was superior to the god of the nation which had been conquered. Nebuchadnezzar's god was superior to Israel's god. As an illustration, if you can remember the story in Samuel, when the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant and they put it in the temple of Dagon. Now, the Israelites didn't have any idols, so the conquering nation took the Ark of the Covenant, which was a sacred article, and they put that instead in the house of their own god Dagon. And we know the answer was that God showed that he was not inferior to Dagon, because Dagon fell over in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Well, here again, the vessels from the house of God, the most sacred, treasured vessels from the sanctuary, these are taken and they are placed in the house of the god in Babylon. The message is, your God is powerless. Our God has conquered your God. Your God is not able to defend you. This is the impression that often comes across in our society. Your God is powerless. There is crime, there is injustice, there are floods and earthquakes and all sorts of things happen. There is hunger, there is starvation. Where is your God? He is powerless. He's a lame duck. That's the type of impression that comes across from people in general. These pressures are sometimes felt by God's people, religious pressures. Secondly, what I've called social pressures, the names of these men were changed. All of their names contained part of some of the names of God, the Hebrews' God. And now their new names contain part of the names of Babylonian gods. So it's a sort of social come religious pressure. There is a religious element in this pressure that's put upon them, as their whole outlook on life is to be reoriented, and they are even given new names so that they can become part and parcel of this new society. Thirdly, educational pressures. They're to be fitted for a new world, a new educational system, where they are to be trained in law, astrology, magic, enchantments, and all sorts of other things that were part and parcel of the wisdom of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans are usually simply Babylonians in the language of the Bible. But in the book of Daniel, it's obvious that the Chaldeans are specifically a group of Babylonians who have perpetuated the ancient religion of the Chaldeans, and they had to learn the language of the Chaldeans in verse 4. A certain mystique attached to these religions. We get it today, of course, in Buddhism, for example, where the priests will chant in Pali or Sanskrit, even in the Roman Catholic Church with the use of Latin in the Mass, where there is a certain mystique that attaches to these ancient languages. Well, so it was here with these Babylonians. They had to learn all the language of the Chaldeans and these other odd practices which went with the whole educational structure of Babylon. Educational pressures. Finally, personal pressures, in that they were served up food and drink which they felt themselves unable to accept. And then the story goes on to develop how this food and drink issue was handled. So that's the main one that's dealt with in the verses which follow. Now, as we read it through, we find that Daniel and his friends refused to eat the food and drink which the king had prepared for them. And we ask ourselves the question, why? Why be difficult? As you read the story of Daniel through, you find that Daniel is not a person who's hard to get on with. He's not a stick in the mud. In fact, I get the impression that he's a fairly accommodating sort of chap. He is not provocative, and he is not an ascetic. And by an ascetic, I mean a person who does not eat certain foods and does not drink certain drinks. In fact, if you go over towards the end of the book, on one occasion Daniel refrained for 3 weeks from eating food as he normally would and drinking wine. He was mourning and he was missing these things. In other words, normally Daniel was a person who enjoyed the good things of life, including good food and good drink. Here he refuses them. Later on, Jeremiah wrote a letter to the Jewish captives in Babylon, and he told them that they were to make the most of things. He said, accommodate as best you can to the new place where you are. Plant fields, build houses, settle down, eat their food, drink their drink, and seek the welfare of the place where you have been taken to. And yet Daniel here seems to be acting in an opposite way. And we're further bothered by Daniel's refusal when we think of some of the things that are said in the New Testament. After all, did not Jesus say on one occasion, it's not what goes into your mouth that makes a person unclean, but what comes out of your mouth? And was not Peter rebuked when he said, but Lord, I haven't ever eaten things which are common or unclean? And a voice said, don't you call common or unclean the good things which God has made for you to eat? And wasn't it Paul who in 1 Timothy chapter 4 said that God has created everything good, speaking of food and drink in particular, and that these things are to be received with thanksgiving? And the same Paul elsewhere said that the kingdom of God is not concerned with such things as food and drink, but rather with righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. They are the important elements in the kingdom of God. Why then is Daniel being so difficult? The answer, I believe, is that Daniel was still under the old covenant. He was an Israelite. He was part of the Jewish nation. And that nation was bound to God by a covenant. There were many requirements in that covenant, and some of them were food laws. And according to those laws, certain foods were prohibited. Now, whether the food here is refused by Daniel because it was of a type that Israelites could not eat, or whether it was refused because it had been offered to idols and had idolatrous associations, either way, it involved a transgression of things that were plainly written in the law code given to Israel, and Daniel was still under that law code. Therefore, he refused. He refused to disobey what was a clear law. He had the Bible's clear direction, and that's why he took his stand. We find it very difficult at times to know when to refuse things and when to do things. And it's very, very difficult at times to see the difference between what is a clear law and what is simply a tradition. In this case, it's a clear law. Now, sometimes we find ourselves involved in clubs or in the office social or in some other social event or parties or friendships, and Christians have this hang-up. What should they do? Well, I don't have any clear answer as to what we're to do in each particular case, but I do think we have a guideline here that we are to look. Is it simply a hang-up that we have because of our ecclesiastical type culture that we've been born and bred in? Is it simply just a hang-up that really isn't a matter of great import, but somehow we have a mental block in these things? Is that all it is? Or is it something that is specifically outlawed by God's word? We have to make up our own mind here. And Daniel tells us that where there was the Bible's clear direction, then he stood firm. Now, it cost him something. He risked his life. You didn't deny those ancient kings and expect that you were going to get away with it. He sacrificed possibly promotion. Well, certainly he put his promotion at risk. And he did so, let us note, without any power base. He had no supporters. He had no people of influence who could back him up. And yet he stood firm simply because he had that conviction and he knew how to act boldly yet sensibly. And that's the point I want to emphasize here. Boldly yet sensibly. In the New Testament, Paul tells us to speak the truth, but to speak it in love. And if I can adapt that, he stands for the truth, but he does so in love. He does so sensibly. He doesn't deliberately create problems for other people, as Christians are sometimes prone to do. He works out a way whereby he can keep doing the thing he's doing. He can keep on being educated and living in the king's palace, and he can refuse the food and yet still maintain his position. So it's rather clever the way he's done it here. In fact, it's almost a little humorous as you read it through. In verse 10, well, first of all, he puts to the chief eunuch the proposition that he doesn't want to eat this food. And of course, the man in charge of the royal household is rather afraid of this, because if the king finds out that the head of the royal household has been accommodating to these chaps in this way, well, he himself, the head of the royal household, might get his head chopped off. And of course, Daniel and the others might lose their heads as well. So when Daniel says that he doesn't want to eat this food, understandably, the chief eunuch is quite perturbed. In verse 10, he said to Daniel, "I fear lest my lord the king, who appointed your food and your drink, should see that you're poorer in condition than the youths who are of your own age," the other youths there who are of your age, "and so you would endanger my head with the king." Notice what Daniel does. He says, "All right, I can't do anything with the chief eunuch, but I'll see what I can do with the chief dining steward." You see, the chief eunuch was over the whole of the household, not only the dining room, but the bedrooms and the bathrooms and the stables and the courtyard and all the other areas of the royal household. So Daniel didn't speak any further with the chief eunuch, but he now spoke to the dining steward in verse 11, whom the chief of the eunuchs had appointed over Daniel and his three friends. And he said, "Well, look, test us for 10 days. When the food is served up, you can take it and eat it yourselves, so that the rest of the people don't get suspicious. You take the food and you can have it, and instead just bring us simple vegetarian meals." And then at the end of the 10 days, in verse 13, he says, "You can test and see just what we look like." Well, the chief dining steward thought that was a marvelous idea, and for the next 10 days, he and a few of his friends certainly had better meals than they'd had for quite a while. And in verse 15, after that period of time, it was disclosed that Daniel and his three friends were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's rich food. And so the chief dining steward and a couple of his mates rubbed their hands together and they said, "Well, that looks good now for the next 3 years." And so in verse 16, the steward took away their rich food. He didn't take it away and throw it in the rubbish tin. He took it away, obviously, and enjoyed it himself. He took away the rich food and the wine, and he gave them instead vegetables. So it was a perfect arrangement, and everybody was happy. The dining steward was happy, the chief eunuch was quite happy, and Daniel, of course, was quite happy. Now, there was a very sensible way of getting around the problem. Notice, he stood firm. Yes, you might say he compromised, but he didn't compromise on anything that was a clear biblical direction. He maintained his faithfulness to what the law taught, and at the same time he came through and was able to progress in the work which he was doing because he had acted courageously, boldly, and yet sensibly. And the result was that all those different pressures which were put upon him didn't really change him. He came through victorious. For example, the religious pressures. At the end of the time, we find that Daniel and his friends outstripped the others. God is in control. God is more powerful. The impression had been put across to them that their God was a tin pot God and he wasn't as good as the Babylonians' God. But now it's revealed that God, the God of the Hebrews, is more powerful and he does look after his own. Secondly, the social pressures, change of names and the general adjustment to the new society. God's kingdom was not swamped by man's kingdom in spite of all these things. The educational pressures, we find that that also did not affect Daniel and his friends. They progressed. In verse 20 it says, in every matter of wisdom and understanding concerning which the king inquired of them, at the end of the 3 years that is, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. These wise men are an odd assortment, wizards, magicians, enchanters and the like. Daniel and his friends were trained in these things, and yet they had learned to discern between what was good and what was bad in Babylonian wisdom. They had no problems with studies of heathen culture and heathen religion because they had a sound knowledge of God. People very often get suspicious of the educational system today and they say they want to take their children out of this and put them in a nice, cozy Christian institution where they're not going to be exposed to all these wrong ideas as they see them. But I don't really see that that helps very much. Sooner or later we have to live in this world. And here's a case of these men who were educated in things which weren't exactly according to the law of Moses, with all the law and astrology of these ancient mystical religions, and yet they were able to pick the good from the bad. And it's very instructive also, I think, that it helped them to understand the thought and culture of the people around them. And if we're going to make any impact upon the people around us, there's no point in our isolating ourselves from them. We have to understand them. So when we find that there are these different values which are taught them, it's good for us that we know these things. But if we have our feet on the ground and this sound knowledge of God and his word, we need not fear these pressures. And so it was that Daniel and his friends came through victorious once again, and of course in the personal issue of the food and drink we've seen already that they lost nothing. The final verse tells us that Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. That is, looking ahead in the story, approximately 70 years. It was approximately 70 years from the time that Babylon first attacked Jerusalem and took these youths off to Babylon. It was approximately 70 years from that time to the time that Babylon eventually fell to Persia, and the king of Persia, Cyrus, immediately gave permission to the Jews to return to their land. What he's saying here is this, that Daniel lasted on and outlived the Babylonian Empire. Now that completes chapter 1, but it hasn't by any means completed my talk, because I now want to look for a few minutes at Isaiah chapter 14. Could you go back please to Isaiah chapter 14? We have here, in the passage that we're looking at, we have a conflict, you might say, between God and the forces of anti-God. Or if you like, a conflict between the people of God who are in a hostile environment and the person who is controlling that hostile environment. And the person is, of course, Nebuchadnezzar. In Isaiah chapters 13 and 14, the prophet, at the beginning of chapter 13 it says, the prophet brings an oracle, a message from God concerning Babylon. And what he wants to say is this, that Babylon is doomed. Specifically, he speaks of the king of Babylon, because the whole system of Babylon, in its opposition to God, is embodied in the king himself. And the king of Babylon that is repeatedly referred to and denounced in the prophets is, of course, Nebuchadnezzar. Now we're going to see in our next talk in chapters 2, 3 and 4 how there is this conflict between Daniel and his friends on one hand and Nebuchadnezzar and his aims and ambitions on the other. And if you read Isaiah and Jeremiah, you'll find in both those books that Nebuchadnezzar is always the king of Babylon who features in those stories where the prophets are denouncing the enemy or talking about the punishment that God is going to bring upon Israel through the Babylonians and how Nebuchadnezzar is going to mince them up and take control of them. Well, now he looks past that and he sees the end of Nebuchadnezzar. He sees the end of Babylon. And this man, Nebuchadnezzar, who has exalted himself and decided that he is going to take over the Hebrew nation and he's going to change the people and make them Babylonian, this man Nebuchadnezzar now is going to get his comeuppance. And that's the message of Isaiah 13 and 14. Now we'll just read some rather colourful pieces in chapter 14. Starts off in verse 4, take up this taunt song against the king of Babylon. A taunt song. It's a song that is sung to taunt him, to disgrace him, to sing a song which reminds him of the great disgrace and humility that has brought upon this person who strutted around so proudly, that says how the oppressor has ceased. The oppressor, of course, Nebuchadnezzar. His insolent fury ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers that smote the people in wrath with unceasing blows, that ruled the nations in anger with unrelenting persecution. This man Nebuchadnezzar, who's ruled these nations and taken these Hebrews into captivity, who breaks the staff, who establishes power, God has now brought him to an end. And then the picture changes in verse 9. And it changes to the underworld, Sheol, the world of the dead. You've just got to picture yourself here in Sheol for a minute. It's not a terribly pleasant thing to picture, but if you can just transfer yourself from these nice comfortable chairs down into the world of the dead, and it's an eerie place with weird forms, grotesque creatures rattling around, skeletons, eyes popping out of their sockets, luminous lights coming out from behind white bones, and maggots and grubs crawling around eating decayed flesh. It's pretty horrible. And guess who has just arrived? Crown on his head, perhaps, I don't know, still a bit of gold and purple finery around him, gold chain, maybe still around his neck. And down he comes now into this eerie, shadowy, smelly, cold world of the dead. And Sheol in verse 9, Sheol beneath, is stirred up to meet you when you come. You, of course, the king of Babylon, to whom the song is addressed. It rouses the shades to greet you, all who are leaders of the earth. It raises from their thrones all who were kings of the nations. It brings them down here now from their thrones into the land of the dead. And all of them will speak, and they'll say to you in verse 10, and now you've got to change your voice a little bit and think of something that's horrible and crackly. And they say, you too have become as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, the sound of your harps. Maggots are the bed beneath you. Lovely stuff. And worms are your covering. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. One after the other, Nebuchadnezzar had picked them off. And now, of course, the Jewish nation, people there in Babylon, and he's training these chaps to be administrators because he's going to completely take over Israel and he doesn't intend ever handing it back. And this man, proud, ambitious, seeking the highest place, the greatest honor and supreme power, is now brought down to the lowest place, greatest shame and complete weakness. You said in your heart in verse 13, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit in the mount of assembly in the far north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds and I'll make myself like the Most High. But now you're brought down to Sheol to the depths of the pit. You strutted around there on the roof of Babylon, and you said, is not this great Babylon which I have built, isn't this going to be for the glory of my majesty? There's not much majesty where you are now, Nebuchadnezzar, with all the worms and maggots crawling over you, lolling around there, your eyes now dropping out and bits of flesh hanging off. All the creepy crawlies are getting their feast on you. And so all in verse 16 who see you now stare at you, and they ponder over you, and they say, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities? Is this the character, the one that had that army that forged through and got victory after victory and took people into captivity, and at the end of the verse would not let the prisoners go home, held those Jews in captive there? Is this the man? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. He thinks of the magnificent tomb some of these kings built for themselves, beautiful marble, gold lettering engraved, here lies King the Great, calf of the black cow, ostrich whose feet devour the desert, conqueror of nations, and so on and so on and so on. They lie in glory, he says, but you, verse 19, you are cast away from your sepulchre, like a loathed untimely birth, clothed with the slain, those pierced by the sword who go down to the stones of the pit, and like a dead body you will be trodden underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land and slain your people. Well, there it is. But Daniel continued till the reign of Cyrus. I believe that the writer of Daniel chapter 1 put that there as the very last verse of the chapter to highlight the contrast. This man who stood firm, Daniel stood firm against Nebuchadnezzar and all the pressures that Nebuchadnezzar had brought to bear upon him. Daniel and his friends, they stood firm. And now here we find that Nebuchadnezzar is the one, in spite of all his power and might and glory, he's the one that finishes up in this horrible, smelly place. Not only that, but the great kingdom which he built, that magnificent empire which ruled all the world as the people in that part knew it at that time in history. This great ruler, his empire that he'd built, eventually crumbled, eventually was destroyed, and the Persians came in instead. Cyrus the Persian brought the Babylonian Empire to an end, and then he established a new era and a new empire. Babylon is finished, Nebuchadnezzar is finished, but Daniel still goes marching on. And I believe that the point that the writer is making in chapter 1 of Daniel is this. Here we have these men who were under the total power of the Babylonian state. And if you want to make some sort of parallel with our present environment and the society we live in and the minority of Christians we have in this society, the pressures brought to bear upon Christians in this society, well, please make that parallel. But I'll just concentrate here now on the point that the man in Daniel concentrates on, that this whole might of the Babylonian system is over the top of Daniel and his friends. And yet Daniel and his friends, they stand firm, sensibly, they find a way through. They advance in their society. They get on educationally. They realize that they are in the place, and there's no sense in trying to get out of the place. They may not agree with all the wisdom, they may not agree with all the things that go on. Nevertheless, they find a way through. They maintain a sensible, positive, constructive approach. They don't go and build themselves a little monastery somewhere. They don't go off and say, we're going to plant our own Christian community where we're not going to be affected by the ills of society. No. They live in that society for better or for worse. They're educated in that society for better or for worse. And whatever happens, they're going to see it through. And they do see it through, sensibly, constructively, being obedient to God and the things that require obedience to the law, and in things which are peripheral, they are able to accommodate so that they protect their faith and keep themselves pure, while at the same time they are part of that society and able to make an impact upon it. because they understand how it works, and their faith in God works itself out in that environment. And the great system that you might say is imposing its colouring upon them, that eventually dies. And the great king who has been behind it all, he finishes up in the place of the dead. And Daniel not only outlasts Nebuchadnezzar, but he outlasts Nebuchadnezzar's successor, and he outlasts even the Babylonian kingdom. Daniel continued till the reign of Cyrus. Let me read you something that really summarizes all this in the book which speaks about the new covenant, namely the book of Hebrews. You don't need to turn to it, I just want to read you one verse from the book of Hebrews. And the writer says to Christians, "Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus let us offer to God acceptable worship, acceptable service, with reverence and awe, fearing God, obeying God, but realizing that in spite of whatever pressures there are, we are part of a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And as we offer to God this acceptable worship, let us realize what Nebuchadnezzar failed to realize, that our God is a consuming fire."